All right, I will call the Committee of Children and Families, Finance and Policy to order. I believe there is a quorum present. And I don't know if anyone's had a chance to look over the minutes from the previous meeting, but if they have, if they would please give a motion.
I would move the minutes, approval of the minutes from our last meeting on February 19th, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Chair, or Vice Chair. Co-chair, I don't know what it is. Representative Carly or Katiza Batun, thank you for that. We have a motion to move the minutes from February 19th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. It's carried. There we go. Nolan's a little bit late today. He will be coming back in a few minutes, or be here in a little bit. But first we have a couple of bill hearings today. First we will hear one from Representative Nadeau, House File 1247.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I move House File 1247, and I have a DE one as well.
Okay, so the bill is before the committee. Presents the DE one.
Yes.
So go ahead and
can I move the DE one?
The DE one.
I do. I move the DE one.
Okay. I'll. So, okay, that's so moved. Is there any discussion on that?
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative Nadeau, I'm a co-author on the bill, I believe, and I think I carried it during the 2023 session. Just curious, and it's an author's amendment, so I'm not going to oppose the change, but I'm just curious if you can give us a little bit of background to how the DE is going to function, if at all differently from the original language.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nadeau.
Representative Katiza Watun. Yeah, so the original bill was drafted, and it's my understanding that it was drafted asking to extend the authorization that you passed in 2023. And the way it was drafted, it would have required a fiscal note, and so ultimately what the DE1 is doing is extending exactly what you did in 23. It's just sunsetting the July 2025 date. That's exactly what it's doing. It's just making it permanent.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, please. What's that?
No, it's all right. Okay. All those in favor of the DE1 say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. So we have the bill before us. Representative Nadeau, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1274 makes the temporary changes that were enacted in 2023 that allowed flexibility during arrival and departure, afternoon departure times, permanent. That flexibility that allows aides in child care centers to supervise children independently for up to 25% of the day, that currently sunsets in 2025. This bill just removes that sunset. DHS was asked if this flexibility had created any data related to negative health or safety impacts in the 18 months that it's been in effect, and the answer was no. This bill also has no fiscal impact on the state. House File 1247 allows the continuation of a practice that helps providers manage their programs in difficult staffing times, ensuring that teachers, who are the highest qualified staff members, can be there for the bulk of the day when most of the children are present. And now I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
All right, if If you would please identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Darielle Dannon, and I'm the contract lobbyist for the Minnesota Child Care Association. Thanks for having me. Thanks for carrying our bill, Representative. I appreciate it. Sorry to be sliding in right as you start, as many of us do, or had something in another committee as well. So thanks for this, members. So as the representative said, the bill's nothing new. So what this does, it continues a current law on a permanent basis. When this bill was put into place in 2023, there were several guardrails included. So one of the big ones is that aides serving in the solo supervisory capacity must be at least 18 years of age. They must also have worked for the child care program for a minimum of 30 days. We're not talking about staff who were hired yesterday and have zero knowledge of children in the program. Before serving in this capacity, any aide who's been employed at the center for less than 90 days would need to complete all of the licensing training required of new child care staff within the first 90 days of employment. Adding to the training that they would have had before they stepped into this role. We're not talking about folks coming in off of the street. We also, and I think Representative Nadeau mentioned this, we had some conversation with the agency just to see if there had been any issues. This was essentially when it was passed in 2023, it was passed on a pilot basis, and it was confirmed that there have been no issues that have arisen because of this, what has been put in place here. So now I'd like to invite MCCA member Jen Orth to share a bit about how this law has helped her, both programmatically and personally.
Thank you, Ms. Orth. If you would please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Jen Orth. I am the owner of High Point Child Care, which operates locations in Lakeville and Rosemont. I'm here today to express my strong support for House File 1247 and to share a little bit about the impact this policy has had on both of my programs. This legislation is essential to the continued success of the child care centers across our state. Without it, we will face increased staff burnout, higher turnover rates, and operational challenges that directly affect the quality of our child care programs and the education we provide to young children. In September of 2024, my center was forced to reduce our operating hours due to staffing shortages. This was a difficult decision because we knew it would affect our families that were relying on the hours of operation that we had to cut. Even with this adjustment, we continue to operate for 10 and a half hours every day, with children in care for 8.5 to 10 hours each day. Our staff members work 8-hour shifts, creating staffing challenges both at the beginning and at the end of the day. The core of our educational day occurs between 9 a.m. and 4:30, with the hours before and after serving as transitional times for drop-off, breakfast, pickup, and free play, with aides being permitted to supervise up to 25% of the day independently. They can manage the morning and late afternoon transitions, allowing our teachers to be scheduled during the critical learning hours. With this flexibility, I have been able to schedule teachers more strategically, ensuring that they are present when their expertise is much more needed, rather than requiring them to cover the early mornings and late nights. This has significantly reduced the need for overtime, which is crucial, preventing burnout and keeping the cost of childcare low, which is a pressing issue in early childhood education. More importantly, allowing aides to supervise up to 25% of the day independently has had no negative impact on the quality of care, safety, or well-being of the children at our centers. Instead, it has fostered a more balanced and suitable work environment while maintaining the high quality our families have known to expect. On a personal level, this policy has allowed me the flexibility of being present for my own children, seeing them off to school in the morning and welcoming them home in the afternoon, something that was not possible before this legislation. Before that, I often had to cover early morning shifts and late afternoon shifts myself, contributing to my own stress and my burnout. This additional time with my children has been invaluable, and I sincerely hope it remains unchanged. If we revert to previous regulations, the negative impact on the staff, retention, burnout, and overall stability of childcare programs will be significant. I urge you to support this bill to ensure that child care providers can maintain high quality programs while addressing the workforce challenges. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Orth. Is there any other member of the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I will close public testimony and go to member questions. Are there any member questions? Representative Dindo, Very good bill, it seems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I think it was partly because of all the co-authors in this committee on it and all the work that was done in 2023 to get it passed. Making it permanent is great. And just to reiterate, the same language was passed in an amendment in the Senate. So they moved that bill, I think, to their general register. And with that, I hope everyone can support this bill. And I renew my motion, and I'm not sure where we're going.
General Register.
I renew my motion that that House File 1247 be passed and moved to the General Register.
Representative Doe moves that House File 1247 be referred to the General Register as amended. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? You are on your way. The motion prevails.
Look at that. Nice job. Way to go, guys. Thank you so much.
Next on the agenda, House File 628. Chair Torkelson, the Chair of Ways and Means, is before us today. And I will move House File 628 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Chair Torkelson, you have a DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like it?
Yes, please.
I will move the DE1 to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Now that the bill is in the shape you would like it, feel free to begin your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of feel like I should have brought treats today because I've never appeared before this committee before, but I've been so busy getting my steps in, walking between the Centennial Office Building, the Capitol, and the Senate Building, that I just didn't have time to get treats. So I beg your forgiveness, and I look forward to maybe the next time I'm here bringing some treats, because you all look hungry. Maybe you're just hungry for information. Anyway, House File 628, as you mentioned, is being held over, and for good reason. This bill is not perfect, but it does address some of the important issues around child care and child care regulation here in the state of Minnesota. As I'm sure you all know, we have kind of a complicated situation in existence because we have a lot of the rules, a lot of the language that governs child care is in rules and other parts of it are in statute, and that's a bit of a mess. And at the same time, the department is also in this evaluation and rewriting some of the rules and regulations around child care. So I fully realize this is an ongoing conversation, but I've had the pleasure of getting to know my testifier. I've been at her business in Redwood Falls, where they do great work, and she's had some deep-seated concerns for a long time now, and it's my pleasure to finally get her before this committee, and I'm very happy to support her efforts to improve the situation here in the state of Minnesota so that child care can be more affordable and more accessible for parents and children across the state. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to, if you would turn it over to my testifier.
Would you please introduce yourself and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for this opportunity. My name is Maria Harms. I'm the owner and director of Snugs-a-Bug Childcare in the rural town of Redwood Falls, Minnesota. I'm here today to express serious concerns for the childcare industry. I would like to speak specifically to the mountain of regulations we are required to integrate into our business model and to share my experience. After receiving an education in business management and child development, I have had the privilege of starting and operating a home-based daycare, leading a childcare director in private and public schools, leading as director in private and public child care centers, and leading as director of a nonprofit child care center. I have also had the privilege to be on the inside of the licensing department as an intern for the child care division in Fargo, North Dakota. All of these experiences provided me the knowledge and confidence to build and operate my own center with the capacity to serve 74 children. While gaining experience, I obtained my master's degree in education administration and leadership. Additionally, I obtained a license in community education, preschool to 12th grade school principal license, and preschool to 12th grade school superintendent license. A revision of licensing standards is currently in process. both the current regulatory standards and the newly proposed modifications will continue to cause serious harm to the child care industry due to the amount and depth of regulation. Child care is the backbone to a productive working economy. Regulatory standards, in my experience, should address safety-oriented policy. For example, emergency preparedness plans, risk reduction plans, detailed child information, and ongoing trainings. However, within these important guidelines, there are many subparts that are not beneficial, in fact, cause issues for providers within our state. Rules, in my experience, should be most beneficial if written to the people who uphold the values of professional care for children, not to the people that break the rules and avoid best practices. Human error in this field will always exist. Licensor personnel are there to identify those operations that need extra attention, guidance, and correction. We are currently experiencing staff shortages exacerbated by regulation, which create capacity issues and directly affect sustainability. The industry also faces revenue limits based on child-to-staff ratios and pricing structure driven by affordability for families. Success in any business is based on good people and competent performance. Regulations state who can or cannot care for children in the classroom. The rules are based on child-oriented education, experience, and age. In my experience, those three components do not always create the best individual for the role. I have worked with wonderful educators without a degree and minimal experience. For example, my mother has been a registered nurse for 40 years and does not qualify on that alone to be a teacher in my classroom. Leaders with appropriate education and experience, such as myself and many in the field, should have the ability to hire quality people and train them for the role they hold and play within the childcare facility. We need people that are willing to learn and positively pour into children's hearts and minds, not just someone who was willing to and could afford an education, though education is always an additional benefit. Children are our most precious commodity and deserve quality people that receive commensurate pay. We in the childcare business currently cannot afford to pay our people what their important role deserves. This reality is governed by regulatory issues, and in addition to the childcare operational challenges, it also results in creating affordability issues for families. We have an incredible opportunity here and now to effectively launch this vital childcare industry to success into the future. Attracting quality people and giving them a respected career while supporting families and meeting their basic needs should be our priority. This change starts with the rules and regulations that guide our industry. I understand the complexity of this process and that my five-minute summary barely scratches the surface of depth involved in this process. I'm willing to invest the time that it will take to effectively legislate for a safe and prosperous childcare industry. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Arms. Is there any other member of the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and move on to member discussion, starting with Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Torkelson, for bringing this bill. I think it's nice to have a new member before the committee, because I think the child care is something that we all should be caring about, and this is a relatively small committee, so thank you for bringing this. And it's a big bill with lots of different ideas. I guess my first question is, how does, you know, you talked about affordability. I think it's something we all care about. How does this bill address the affordability issue that we're seeing across our state? I think I'm a little bit struggling to see how changing some of these regulations, how would it affect affordability?
So the Ms. main... Arms. Oh, I apologize. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Mr. Chair, I would like to turn the question over to my testifier.
Thank you. To answer your question, the main part of our bill is addressing the staff qualifications. So in order to have teachers, assistant teachers, and aides within the classroom, they have to be qualified. So they have to get an education. They have to do so many hours in the classroom, which in turn requires us to pay them more. If we have to charge more or pay our staff higher, we have to charge families more to make up for that gap.
Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifier. So I guess, you know, for me, and I'll just make a comment, and then I have a couple other questions. That's concerning to me because I believe that we need to be paying childcare workers more. So I'm concerned about, you know, if the affordability in this bill comes from paying the people that are doing the most important work of caring for our children less, you know, I just fundamentally don't think that's the solution. I agree with you about the problem, but I'm not sure that that's the place that we should be cutting costs. I do have a couple more questions, Chair, if I can. Okay. So I think broadly, I'm wondering, like, I too have heard that there's too many regulations in childcare. I would say that the ones that are addressed in this bill are different than the ones that I have heard about. So, you know, a couple of things I have questions about. One is, you know, it seems like part of the bill is getting rid of kind of the information that you're collecting from families and how much information you need to ask for and how much information the child care center needs to hold. I think I'm wondering, like, why, can we speak a little bit more to why that change is needed? Is it that collecting that information is too burdensome? Is that holding on to that information is too burdensome? You know, I think we're always trying to figure out what is the right balance between regulations that keep our kids safe and regulations that are too, you know, overburdensome. I feel like, to me, you know, thinking about my kids at daycare, he falls, get hurt, I'm in the middle of committee, I'm not checking my phone, I want grandma's number right there so they can, like, and to me that doesn't feel like it's super burdensome for me as a parent, for the center. So can you talk about why some of the data pieces are being changed, and who is that helping? How is that helping our centers?
Mr. Chair, once again, I'd like to, if you don't mind, turn it over to my testifier.
Ms. Arms.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the question. I do want to preface overall that funding to the childcare industry could absolutely increase. I think that's a whole nother animal. To your question about the information, what I find in the center is oftentimes there are families that don't have family close, so we have to require two emergency contacts, and we need to have the medical information and the dental information for emergencies. However, me as a practitioner in the field, if your child falls and jams their teeth on the playground, I'm going to call 911. I'm not going to look up their record on which dentist that you as a parent want me to use. I value that. I value that you give me the information, but in an emergency like that, I'm always going to turn to 911. I understand that's good to know if we can't reach a parent or the emergency contact, but it shouldn't be required from the center. If a certain center wants to ask for that, great. But I don't think as a state we should be requiring extensive information. I think that is something that will differentiate one child care to another as well and increase the parent choice on where they're sending their child.
Representative Sensimura.
Thank you. And I don't want to take up too much time, so I guess I would say, you know, I would be interested, maybe it's this committee session, maybe it's a different date, to hear kind of DHS talk about that and why we have that regulation and how they would feel about changing it. My last question is about the director role, and this might be a question for nonpartisan. So I see that we're changing some things about the director role, and I'm wondering kind of what... Can someone explain, like, the differences right now between, you know, how much a director needs to be in the center versus how much a teacher needs to be in the center, and would this bill change that? So I think my question is, like, currently does a director, how many hours a week or a day do they need to be present in the center, and how does this bill change that? And either for the bill author or for nonpartisan.
Mr.
Chair, I'd be happy to turn this over to nonpartisan.
Ms. Ma.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am not aware of any requirements under current law or rules requiring how many hours a director needs to be in the center. I'm not sure that I answered the question.
And then does this bill change that at all?
Ms. Ma.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what this bill does with the director is it basically identifies a number of qualifications that a director must have. Under current law or under current rules, a director would have to have those same qualifications if the director was ever going to function as a teacher within the center. But if the director wasn't going to function as a teacher, then the director would not have to have all these qualifications that are listed here. And I don't know how often or how common it is for a director to function as a teacher in a center, and how likely it is that most directors have these qualifications already.
Representative Sensimura.
Thank you. And just one final question, if I can. So this is to Chair Torkelson. Just wondering, who have you been working on this bill? Who have you been consulting with on this bill?
Chair Torkelson. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been working with my constituent and with Nonpartisan as we kind of journey through these very complex areas. And as I stated earlier, and as you know, there's the revised child care center licensing standards are being discussed really as we speak, and it's kind of my hope that we might have some influence on that process and really come up with some changes that make this system work more efficiently, so that we encourage people to be involved in this industry and can operate profitably in the child care industry, so that we have child care available for the parents in my district and all the other districts all across the state.
Thank you.
Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Torkelson, for being here. I am likewise grateful that you're interested in engaging in this conversation. I was fortunate. I was trying to remember when it was, but I was fortunate enough to go down to your district and visit New Ulm and hear from some providers and some folks involved in child care issues down there, and have a really good conversation there. So I'm glad that you are here. I want to begin just by asking a few questions to make sure I understand things correctly. So this bill removes both the qualifications around what is required to be a substitute teacher, as well as the 240-hour limit per calendar year for use of substitute teachers. Am I correct in that understanding?
Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe you are. Representative Coulter, I would again turn to my testifier if she has any comments on that issue.
Yeah, that is. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. That is not what the bill is stating. Essentially, the bill is stating that the director needs to hold the education and the experience within the child care industry and can train the staff, and it would eliminate the teacher, assistant teacher aide qualification, and train those people into the role that they're holding. So substitutes would fall under that as being staff, so long as they have the correct trainings and familiarity with the center.
Representative Coulter.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there may be, we can come back to that, because I that's not the way I understood it, but we can come back to that. My second question is this bill removes some requirements around individual care and education needs of children. And, you know, as a parent of a child with an IEP, that is concerning to me, because we know, obviously, and we're learning more every day about how some of those individualized care needs assert themselves even at very young ages. Can you just sort of explain the thinking behind that and how you see that playing out?
Chair Torkelson.
Again, I will.
Ms. Irons.
My testimony.
Thank you. I don't want to take that away, and that's not the goal of this. However, we're already required to get the child information, their habits, their allergies, all of the necessary things. But in addition to those, we have to get extra documentation, and we don't have the authority to be given their IEPs without parent and school personnel giving us that okay. Most parents would. However, another piece of, you know, kind of in that is we have to ask parents' permission to call emergency services on behalf of their child if the parent can't be reached. And I look at that as a provider, as if a parent wouldn't give me that permission, would I not call 911 on their behalf? It's just, there's so many rules that I don't want to say it's common sense, but you as a parent with a child that needs an IEP, I would hope as the center, you would provide that to me. I don't believe it should be required. I've had some parents that get pretty squirmy around the special education umbrella, and I do think that's a parent right whether or not you share that. Obviously, if there's further concerns or behavioral issues, that's an important piece to know, and it always is, but I don't think that that needs to be required in the level and depth that it is to be a provider's responsibility.
Representative Colton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. That's helpful, and I think it it illustrates, frankly, a number of concerns that I have about this bill. And those of us who've been on this committee for a few years have heard these statistics before. 80% of brain development happens by age 3 and 90% by age 5. Childcare is education. And I get a little bit anxious when we act as though it's not, because particularly given the numbers that I just mentioned, it in some ways it's arguably more important education than kids will receive at any other time in their lives. And you mentioned that this bill primarily focuses on qualifications, and that is true. And that's where I have a problem, because we know childcare is a serious, I continue to believe it is the biggest social and economic issue we face in the state of Minnesota, and I would say nationally right now. We are not going to solve the childcare crisis by engaging in a race to the bottom. And my fear is that by looking at qualifications and saying that we will make childcare more affordable because we will pay folks less because they will be less qualified, we are, I think, not only doing a disservice to the industry by ignoring the very real issues, the very real economic issues that make childcare a broken system that we have talked about, but more importantly, we're doing a disservice to the kids. And I know that's not your intent, and I don't want you to think that that's what I'm saying. But I do not think going after qualifications, going after education, which is important, that I don't think that's the way to really truly address the very fundamental issues that exist in childcare. So I'm glad that we are having the conversation. I'm glad it will continue. And I do believe there are ways that we can right-size regulations to better address needs, to make sure that the folks who are providing this important care can do the best job that they can do. But I just, going after qualifications to me is just not the way to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Colter.
Mr. Chair, my testifier.
I'm just going to take a tiny little bit myself as chair. It's one of the fun things you get
lovely.
To do. I understand where you're coming from, Representative Colter, but as you mentioned, our child care system is suffering greatly. I'm going to be paying almost my entire legislative salary in daycare costs once Sloan goes to daycare or child care. And to say that we cannot look at this or that any reduction in qualifications is completely unacceptable basically says every parent with their first child isn't fit to raise their child if they choose to stay at home and raise their child, like being a little hyperbolic. But so children don't necessarily need that kind of regimented education. Some parents might want that path, some other parents might not. They learn through play and the social interactions. So I think that's one thing we should keep in mind when we look at these childcare issues. Not that, as the chair said, this bill is not perfect, but it is a discussion, and I don't think we can write off a section of that discussion. Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My testifier would like to react to the comments of Representative Colter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee member. So I don't want to, I guess I misspoke in the fact of lowering qualifications is going to make childcare more affordable, because that's not the case. Getting funding in the childcare world would be very helpful and very needed. But currently, family childcare and center certified exempt centers don't need the qualification. So already in the childcare industry, we have these imbalances, and only childcare center qualified centers need the qualifications for the staff to be considered teachers. So I'm not looking down on the education piece, and I absolutely think it's important to have people that have education, especially in developmental milestones. But to your point, Mr. Chair, we're looking at families and parents and the family centers and the schools and saying that you're not qualified because you don't have the education. And a lot of the times the education is there. There are people that are very active in that, but it also narrows the pool that you can hire from because of people that are or are not qualified and what position they can or cannot hold in the center. So if we don't have staff in the center, we won't have the center, and you won't have the childcare. And the pool of people to pull from gets very small when these regulations are upheld to their current standard.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I don't want to continue to echo some of the concerns, but I do have to address regarding health and safety. As someone who lives with a chronic illness, I was lucky and fortunate, I guess, to say that, you know, it hit me at 16 being type 1 diabetic, which requires insulin dependency and regulations of glucose monitoring. And because of technology, that also costs money with health supplies, but here in the state, we've been able to advocate a lot in our last session for that. I think about the parents that I talk to when I'm mentoring them going through chronic illnesses that children get at like 2 years old, specifically families that are concerned with sending their kids to childcare, trusting the people that they're leaving their kids in childcare with to monitor their glucose or the whatever chronic illness may be. So, you know, I just want to clarify, does this bill prevent a center from having critical medical information which would be used in events of an emergency? How about, like, we want to avoid an emergency from happening. We want to avoid from calling 911. And so it's a little unsettling for me to think that if it, by any means, you know, a parent in this case would take their kids, pay for this program that is accessible because now they're staff and it's less requirements, but that they don't actually have to have critical medical information on my child's well-being of prescription and medication that they need to live on. So can you clarify that a little bit regarding the health and safety? Because that addresses very deep concern for me. And I think we all want our kids to be safe, and that's number one, regardless of where they're at, right? School, childcare. But when we talk about health and safety, if I'm leaving my child in the hands of someone that I've signed a contract for them to receive payment, I would want them to have to be certified in giving them their medication.
Chair Torkelson?
Mr. Chair, I will once again phone a friend.
Ms. Arms.
Thank you, Chair and Commissioner. So currently that is not written in rule that we are required the training for those things. That is conversation with a parent of if a child has a medical need, that we do create a plan and what would happen. We currently have to have a medication authorization form that parents sign. And overall, as the center, I don't want to take away the rules and regulations and the look on safety. But again, if I get a parent that comes in with a child that has diabetes and does not give me all the necessary information that I need to properly handle their child, I don't feel we're fit for that. And when I say that, we would need training. We need proper training. We're not nurses. We're not doctors. So to get the proper training, we do have to have a certain number of hours per year on continued education in some training form. And I would say that if I didn't feel capable in taking care of a child that had a special need, that I would seek training in that area.
Representative Perez-Vega.
So you wouldn't find that to be discriminatory, that you wouldn't have to be responsible, that it would be a responsibility, because I'm not a nurse. I'm not a nurse practitioner. I have had to teach myself how to manage a chronic illness as a teen. But I think about those little ones that were well, their parents being in the room that I learned my diabetic education being diagnosed, to have those questions and concerns of how they're going to deal with furthering their lifestyles in this shocking diagnosis into a space. So, you know, for to hear that that you wouldn't qualify, if you don't qualify to work with one type of kid, how are you going to qualify to work with any other type of kid? So I just, you know, I don't want to linger and drag. This is obviously what, you know, Chair Wes has stated, that this is not a perfect bill, that it's still working and we're still trying to figure things out. We all want childcare, but we all need to be assured, and this is something that I'd like for you to take back to the beautiful town of Redwood Falls. I really love visiting that beautiful town, is that, you know, we want to make things fitting for all of our kids that are going into childcare centers. And to say that I'm not trained in this field means that you're not trained to work with children. And so with someone who, and I would say special needs, with someone who cares about kids, cares about the well-being of all of our children, I want to amplify that we have to really put regulations and qualifications on how we deal with all of our kids, and that health and safety should be required as a number one factor. Thank you.
Would you like to respond, Chair Torkelson?
Well, yeah, I think I would. You know, how much expertise do you expect child care workers to have? We want our children to be safe and well cared for, but turning them into nurse's aides or other practitioners that are well trained to handle specialized situations is something that goes above and beyond. And certainly I would expect that parents would work with the child care center to make sure the children's needs are met and that the children are safe. But to train every child care worker to such a high level is part of the problem here, because it adds a lot of expense.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up on that. So then again, you bring in a child, because believe 16 years old is still not an adult age, right? So, but the qualifier of this bill labels that a 16-year-old can be there in the center without the director supervision there at the entire time. That was also stated. Am I correct? You can answer that.
Chair
the director
Ms. Arms?
Of
the director does not need to be there, but I don't recall the 16 years old. At least 16 years
at
old.
At least 16, yep. Right. Okay. So I'm leaving my child in the care of a 16-year-old who's also a child, to manage whether the child has a condition that can be addressed to a monitor on your phone or your watch or a pump, that is usually like a couple hour training that would have to go under medical clearance. I'm just, you kind of feel where I'm going with this. I'm a little concerned with that. When we talk about the age, when we talk about the health, the safety, and the fact that a director is not legally having to be there full time during the hours of service. So just think about that a little bit. All right, thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in reading the bill, nowhere in Representative Torkelson's bill does it say anything whatsoever about kids not being safe, or that we want to minimize the safety of our children. Our goal is to help reduce the cost of child care and ensure that our rural Minnesota, especially child care centers, remain viable and open. And we just can't keep on throwing money at it, more grants and money, because we are looking at a structural deficit. As you all know, Minnesota is one of the highest cost states in the nation for child care. We have the most safety in child care in the country, and that's a good thing. But in lieu of overabundance of safety, which is always good, it's almost safety on steroids, and therefore the costs are prohibitive for many parents. And if you look at page 3, under section 3.3 and 3.4, regarding a staff person must be 16 years of age and complete the training under sections 142B 65. It'll tell you that they're not just leaving a child, a 16-year-old in there untrained to supervise or watch for a short amount of time. That particular person has to be trained under 142B65, and they have to go through our state statutes because of this committee and others before us, put into our state statutes stringent rules for their very safety of our children, including Representative Perez-Vega, safety first aid, accordance with subdivision 4, which goes into the details of what happens in the case of a diabetes and other first aid conditions. This is giving, as I read the bill, the language, because that's important, the flexibility for child care centers to be able to lessen the rules, but yet still with the utmost safety, so they can reduce the price, increase the cost and the burdens. As Representative Torkin said, it's not perfect. There are some things in here that I question as well, like the phone numbers, but that's minor and that could be changed with an amendment. It's not mission critical. But I think we got to get out of that Republican-Democrat fighting back and forth all the time. This is a good bill that we could work together to really solve a problem that the state has, and we're going to have to work together to get it off the House floor anyway. And you're going to have to give a little, my friends, on the Democrat side, and we'll have to give a little to craft a bill that is affordable and still retains the utmost safety of our children. If you read through the bill and look at the state statutes that the refers to the bill, you'll see there's nothing in there that will minimize the safety of our children at all. And this is a good start, Representative Torkelson, as I continue to dig into it as well. You got my support. And that's all I have to say for right now, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. And I agree, we have a child care problem. And I appreciate creative solutions. I'm a little confused because Representative Sensenmura first asked how this would save money, and you said because we would need less training so we wouldn't have to pay them as much. And then you retracted that and said it wouldn't actually save families money. The way to save families money is to put money in the system. Mr. McDonald, or Representative McDonald, just said that this would save money, so I'm a little confused about whether or not it saves money. But we're neither here nor there. I am concerned about safety. I'm also just concerned about discrimination. And Representative Torres said, I am really sorry. I got an email from a really good friend in the inclusive childcare movement in response to this bill, and I would like to forward it with you because there's some really good points in there that I think we should really be talking about. Because regardless or not, if whether or not having more trained staff costs money or doesn't cost money, is harder to find or is not harder to find, regardless of all of those very important components, children with disabilities are children, and they are people, and they deserve equal access to inclusionary childcare spaces, full stop. And when Representative Perez-Vega was talking about some of the health needs, I heard some things that, for me as a parent of children with disabilities, is very painful. Things like, well, that's why things are more expensive. My children having disabilities, other people's children and grandchildren having disabilities does not, and that they need specialized care, does not make them less than, and the problem for affordable childcare. And I think we have to say these really hard things out loud sometimes, because in the mess of this is a lot of money and this is overburdening families and this is really hard, which is all really true, and we have really big shortages and we have to do something, all of that can be true, and simultaneously a child with autism, a child with Down syndrome, a child with diabetes, a child with sickle cell anemia, a child with cystic fibrosis is still a child, and they still deserve access, and they still have both federal and state protections, at least at this point, to that access. And so I would caution everybody when we're talking about childcare and we're talking about children and we're talking about concerns to remember that the people that we're talking about may not all be at the same place as far as their needs and their barriers. And we should talk about people and children especially as children and people first, and then we can talk about why they're more expensive and what kind of supports they need and how we fund some of those things and why that stuff matters. So I need to throw that out there, because as a parent of children with disabilities, I was just like, because as kids with disabilities and adults with disabilities, and frankly seniors as they age and develop disabilities, hear all the time, they're expensive. We know that. But that doesn't mean we don't deserve to live in the world. So I will forward the email from the Inclusive Child Care Center to the committee and to you, Representative. But I would encourage us all to be mindful of the words we use when we speak of people with disabilities, because it is important and it does matter, and we should respond from that space. But that wasn't actually my question. The reason I got on the list, I'm so sorry. The reason I got on the list was because on line 10.25, and I have a bazillion children. So I don't know if you know this about me, but I have a bazillion children. And in Minnesota, you can't even, like, add foster kids if you have more than 8. And, like, you know, you need a waiver. So, like, a bazillion children. And children with really high needs in my home all the time. And then, like, 4 million friends, because for some reason no one ever leaves. But in 10.25, it says the maximum group size applies at all times except during meals, outdoor activities, field trips, naps, rests, special activities such as films, guest speakers, and holiday programs. So does that mean that during those things, the ratio is lower, or the ratio is higher, or it's irrelevant? I wasn't clear.
Well,
Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I believe it's meant to add flexibility to the system. That's my understanding of the language. Plain language would be that.
That's current language.
It's current language, apparently, according to my testifier.
This is how it's written in current rule and regulation right now.
So, and
Den of Hicks.
Oh, thank you, Chair.
So some of the, if Chair I Torkelson. Might interrupt.
You guys are rogue here.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Stop
I'm
it.
Trying to take away your control. Sorry about that. You've done a very good
Ways
job.
Ways means
up to
is
this
going
point.
To your head.
But if you would like to, if you would like to slap my fingers, you can do that later. So some of the language that's underlined in here is because we're moving stuff from rules to statute and back and forth, and it gets complicated, and I don't profess to understand all that. But if you'd like to talk to nonpartisan about it, I'm sure they would love to try to explain it to you.
Thank you.
Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Torkelson is right. This language is in current rules, and so it's just being moved to statute here. And my understanding of this is that if you can think about something like a fire truck arriving at a child care center and you want all the kids to come out and see the fire truck and learn how to stop, drop, and roll, this allows all the kids to be out at one time. So those maximum group sizes don't have to apply, but the ratios still apply.
Thank
Representative
you.
Hicks.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I was like, I don't know what that means. More or less the same? Not clear. So I do appreciate that nonpartisan brought up the ratio, because that's the other place that I get a little nervous. So I've had 3 toddlers in my house before. I had 3 4-year-olds for like a year. It was really rough. So toddlers starting at 16 months, excuse me. So just a little over a year, not quite a year and a half. And 14 of them seems like a lot of little people in diapers trying to learn to potty train without real words and, frankly, no theory of mind skill set. Can you help me understand how the maximum group size numbers were chosen in this particular bill?
Chair Torkelson.
I will phone a friend once more.
Ms. Hires.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee member. So this is also current rule. This is what we currently follow. So they say 1 staff to 7 toddlers with a max of 14 in a room, essentially. I have been in multiple of the conversations about the rule and statute revision when we were given the opportunity. And I have asked several times, how did the rules come about? Oh, well, they were developed in 1980 and a group of people sat together to write them. And I continued to ask because I never got an answer. Who was sitting at the table? Who wrote the rules? Who decides that 1 to 7 is okay, 1 to 8 is not, max group size of 14 is good and 20 is not? And I couldn't get an answer. So I don't have a clear answer for you on to how these were chosen, and that's, I mean, overall part of the issue with the rules is that they're so vast, but we don't know who was at the table to create them and why some numbers are okay and some aren't.
Representative Hicks?
Thank you. I really appreciate that. This is why I don't work in childcare. I need like a small group of multi-aged people in my house, not anywhere else. And maybe this is a question for nonpartisan. The definition of toddler right now in rule is what?
Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the definition in rule right now is the same as it is in this DE1. So it's at least 16 months, but less than 33 months old.
Great, thank you. I appreciate it.
Representative
that.
Hicks.
Thank you so much. And I actually don't disagree with you that conversations about rulemaking versus statute are complex, and that I think there are opportunities in that space to have those more robust conversations. And so I really do appreciate you bringing those conversations forward, because we should be having them, especially as you've shared, given the licensing changes that are coming. So I do appreciate you bringing those forward and having those conversations. I always worry about safety, and I always worry about that with ratios. I worry about it with events. And I also really worry about it with 16-year-olds. My 16-year-old works at a 17 now, works at a school district program, after school program, and does a wonderful job. She's lovely. But she's got a lot of adults around her supervising her. And given some of the conversations we've had about the director, the only person in the center that would be required to have any education, not necessarily currently being required to even be there, I get a little bit nervous about some of those things. But as you've said, this is a first opportunity, a first try. And I think there's definitely opportunity to continue to have conversations. So I wanted to say thank you for that and for that conversation, but also go on the record as, you know, having some concerns around the supervision of the other child, the teenage child as well. So thank you.
Chair Torkelson. Any other members before Chair Katizawatun? Chair Katizawatun.
Thank you, Chair West. I spy with my little eye some DHS folks in the corner, and I'm wondering if they might come up and answer some questions for me. They are coming up. Can you introduce yourself for the record and proceed? Actually, I'll proceed, but I'll ask the question first. Okay. I was like, you're telling me what to do. Okay, so I've got some questions on volunteers, unsupervised volunteers, current training requirements, et cetera. Are there any scenarios currently in which a person who's not employed by a child care center, not working regular hours at a child care center, would be approved to watch children unsupervised?
Please introduce yourself for the record and answer the chair's question.
Thank you so much. My name is Alyssa Dotson, and I am the Deputy Inspector General for the Licensing Division within the Office of Inspector General. I can definitely get back to you on that answer. That kind of goes beyond my top of the head knowledge here. I know there are some requirements for unsupervised volunteers and substitutes in there, but I don't have it right off the top of my head here, so we can definitely get back and answer that.
Chair Katizawatun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I am just hoping that we can kind of wrap our heads around what already may be required for those volunteers, and then if this language would lessen that, or to what degree it would change that. I think that would be really helpful for us as we consider this bill going forward, since it's being laid over. In the many child care centers that I've been able to tour, both in my district and across the state, there tends to be like an infant room, and then a toddler room, and then the toddler two room where they're a little bit older maybe, or if there's just more toddlers that were on the same age. But I'm trying to understand what the circumstances may be currently where there's, aside from an in-home child care provider, where and how many infants and toddlers could be in the same space together.
Ms. Dotson.
Thank you again. Yeah, and again, there are current rules around when age groups can mix and if they have to meet the ratios for the youngest child in that group and for how long. Specifics on those I don't, again, have off the top of my head, so we can get back to you. But definitely there are for centers as they do separate by age groups in these different areas, the requirements of when you can mix, what times of days you can mix those age groups, and how those ratios need to be met to maintain safety of the children in care.
Chair Katizovich.
Thank you. I have my concerns in these questions kind of stem from the idea that a center director at the age of 18 could potentially be employing a number of 16-year-olds, and then those teachers, student teachers perhaps, would be combining larger groups of children of varying age. So I think that's all the questions that I have for you right now, but I would appreciate a follow-up on that. And then I just, Mr. Chair, I did have a comment on in our packets. The Minnesota Child Care Association sent a letter with a variety of concerns about the language of the bill. And I know that the differences between in-home providers and center providers vary currently in rule, and DHS is currently going through a very thorough process of vetting some additional updated standards, and the legislature will be a part of that process. But I share some of their concerns about just, I mean, that 16-year-olds could be a lead teacher, just and then them not having the same type of training that's currently required. I think that there are 16-year-olds who have an incredible heart and capacity for young children. I have four children, and we've had teenagers care for them in a variety of settings, whether that's babysitting here in our home, whether that is in a church setting, whatever it may be. But I have some very real concerns that I share based on the feedback from the Child Care Association. And then just to follow up on some of the health and safety stuff, if the intent is to not lessen the current stringency when it comes to health and safety for children, I guess I'm just confused why the DCYF commissioner should amend rules to change a requirement that a child's record must contain names, addresses, and telephone numbers of their regular medical and dental care folks. Is that something that's in the existing rules as well, and it's coming into this? I don't understand what that means, and I think that there might have been some other confusion if we're not directing them to lessen that, just going from rulemaking to statute. But what are they changing it from, Ms. Mock, if you could enlighten us, because I think that that's where a lot of the confusion is stemming.
Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I'm pulling up the rule right now, so yes, in rules, there are requirements for what a center must have for the children's record. So this of the DE1 Section 5 is telling the Commissioner of Children, Youth, and Families to amend those rules to modify what sort of records the child care center has to keep for each child.
Chair Katizovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's really helpful, and I think because of the again, the rulemaking to statute process, this language does read, Representative Torkelson, that there was maybe going to be some change happening in this bill, but given that brief overview from Ms. Smock, that really helps my clarity, and because I know that certainly based on your testifier's information, that wasn't the intent of the bill. And I know that you yourself have grandchildren and care really deeply about the safety and health of children all across the state. So I'm glad that we were able to clarify that.
Thank you, Chair Katizovich-Toon. I'll make a quick final comment just on the general. As we go through and develop what will have to be a bipartisan bill, one thing I'd like the committee to focus on is a holistic approach. we do all want more money in childcare. We kind of disagree in some areas of what deserves more money than not in the system, but we all agree more money for childcare. We also are aware we have a giant budget deficit. And we'll have an inflationary effect on the cost of childcare if we don't help lower their costs, not just by giving them money, but by making it easier for them to operate. So while this bill, I would say, is aggressive, Representative Nadeau's bill that was beautiful and quick is good, but to me that's not enough. We need to take a more holistic approach by looking at both the regulatory structure and making that easier where it makes sense, and increasing investments. And if we only do one or the other, we're not going to end up where we need to end up, because right now, Minnesota, over $20,000 average cost of infant care for centers, and family child care isn't even that far behind. And our neighboring states are all doing much better on affordability than we are. So we need to take a holistic approach, and that's what I appreciate about your bill, Chair Torkelson, is it focuses on one of these aspects that frequently gets overlooked, and it gets overlooked because it's so dang hard. It's so hard because you have to balance safety. So with that, I will let you close out your bill. Chair Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. If you don't mind, I would allow my testifier to make some closing comments first.
Ms. Harms.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate the time today. I do just want to make it very clear that lowering safety is not the goal. And because I'm new to this and all the processes, the bill that I had read and changed is a little bit different than the one we're going off of. And to the confusion, there are some current rules written in this, so it's kind of hard to differentiate the two. But safety is not wanting to be put on the wayside. There are just extra subparts that aren't necessarily needed, and parent choice in the childcare industry should be a big part as well. So thank you for your consideration, and I look forward to this being something that's further discussed.
Chair Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to thank you for hearing this bill in short order, even though it, as I acknowledged earlier, is not in perfect shape, but it certainly is a conversation starter, and I think that was a very important part of this hearing today. I want to thank my testifier for coming in from Redwood Falls. It's a bit of a drive, as you know, and a sacrifice to take time off from her work schedule to be here. She's been very active in this area, and I appreciate her educating me and now hopefully educating to some extent the entire committee. We have real challenges in this area in Minnesota. I'm glad to hear that this committee takes them seriously and is willing to work hard to figure out some practical solutions to a child care dilemma that I hear about from constituents regularly. Often one of the first topics of conversation with, especially with a young family, is, you know, child care is so hard to find, and we're actually timing our childbirth adventure based on the availability of child care, and that to me just seems wrong. And we need to right wrongs like that. So thanks again for hearing the bill. I will be happy to be as involved as I can. As you know, the money problem is real, and I know it's real because I'm chairing Ways and Means, and anxiously awaiting the February forecast that's coming out now, the 6th of March, and we will all be wrestling with that very soon. So thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. I'll renew my motion to lay over House File 638 for, as amended, for possible inclusion in a later omnibus bill. There we go. I want to thank the committee for another lovely, civil, reasonable discussion that stayed focused on content and not besmirching people. Honestly, my heart sings every single time we have a committee, and I love you all. With that, we are adjourned.